I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Gemma Baisley. Welcome, Gemma.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's lovely to be able to meet you and to talk to you. And for those who don't know, many who are listening to this podcast will, you're the relatively new priest at St. Paul's
in That's right.
Beaconsfield, Fremantle, really.
Yeah.
Congratulations on your appointment, installation.
Thank you so much.
It was, what, October a year ago?
October last year, yeah, so 14 months ago.
And had you ever been to Fremantle before you took this up?
I had been for a couple of hours on my only trip to Australia, which had been 3 years before, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now you're the priest in charge here.
That's right. So they say. Yeah.
And that 3 years ago when you came by for a few hours, what was your official position back then?
So at that point, I was a priest in Hartlepool in the UK. And I had foolishly fallen in love with an Australian. And so his four children were here. So I flew over to meet his kids. And while I was here, he said, I've got to take you to Frio for the day. Everyone goes to Frio. So we got on a train.
You've got the accent down pretty right too.
Oh, I got on a train from Alkimos, came down here for the day, went on the big wheel, ate crepes at Fremantle Market, and then we got back on the train and went back, I think, from what I can remember. And I thought, oh, that's nice.
Well, that's nearly as far as you can go, Alkimos to Fremantle.
It did feel like the edge of civilization at the time.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up, well, when people hear my accent, they say to me, is that Yorkshire? Usually, that's the most often accent that people pick up. But I was actually born in the Midlands, in Coventry, and then gradually moved north. So next I was in West Yorkshire for about 10 years. And then I was on the northeast coast in a little town called Hartlepool. And so then, seeing as I'd gone so far north, I thought, maybe I'll head south next. So I went as far south as you could go and came to Fremantle.
And when you made that journey from Coventry all the way up to Hartlepool, was that when you were young? With
no,
parents, that sort of thing?
No, all of my family are still in Coventry.
Yes.
But I moved to Yorkshire for education, for university, and then for work. Then I came back to Coventry for a while. But once you've lived in West Yorkshire, then it draws you in. It's an amazing place that's very green and super friendly. So then when I trained for the priesthood, there was a college in West Yorkshire. So I went back there. And then when I was ordained, there were no jobs in Coventry, so I had to look elsewhere. But my real passion is about challenging poverty and feeding the hungry, and the poorest place in England is the northeast. And I thought, well, if I want to challenge poverty and house the homeless and stuff, there's no point going to the posh place. So I went to the northeast and had seven really happy years in Hartlepool.
Some of those characteristics that have attracted your mission are probably to be found around Fremantle, but we'll come to that.
Sure.
My family on my father's side were from York, Yorkshire.
Oh, okay.
So I remember,
very beautiful.
It is very beautiful, and I remember though going to that east coast, and it about 10 years ago it looked like one of the places God had forgotten.
Yeah, except it's funny because God lives in Hartlepool, so
well, this goes to trick you.
Yeah, it's quite unlike the northeast coast is unlike anywhere else in England, I think. Yeah, it's pretty rugged. There's the beach where I was living was partly made of coal, And there were still people who would go down to the beach and collect the sea coal and take it away from the beach and dry it out and sell it for fuel. So it was pretty, yeah, it was a really interesting place.
Yes, the anthropologists amongst us would be fascinated by that. It shows how we always lived, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, it's a real flashback.
Now, you mentioned you went to university from Coventry and that took you to West Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
What sorts of things were you studying? Were they relevant to your subsequent priesthood?
I've collected degrees, really, along the way. So my first degree was very useful in dance and drama.
Well, I imagine there are moments.
I mean, to be fair, like, my husband always jokes and says, oh, using your dance and drama degree again. It does come in really handy. Like, I'm really good at walking in processions. I know how to do that. And it really helps with public speaking, and there's a lot of that in this work. So as much as it is quite funny that my first degree was in dance and drama, it is really useful. And then my second degree, my master's degree, was in youth work and young people's teenage pregnancy. So again, directly related to the priesthood. I don't know, baptising babies, maybe. And then my third degree was in theology. So,
well, something obviously twigged for you between the dance and drama and the social study.
Yeah, yeah.
Youth work. So what was it? Or had it always been there?
No, I don't think it had always been there. I did dance and drama because I had a terrible careers advisor who just said, a degree's a degree, just do something that you're interested in. And so I joyfully set off to Huddersfield University in West Yorkshire. And at the end of my first year, I started to think, gosh, if I'd have taken a year out, I probably would have done a social work degree. So something was beginning to tick in my mind. My mum's a real socialist, and my granddad was a real trade unionist. So I've been brought up to always find the underdog and champion them. And, you know, if the systems don't work for the poorest, then they don't work. And that was inherent in me. As I sort of started to stand on my own feet, I guess, I realised I could do something about that, maybe. And so it did start to flicker in me. And then I had a move back to Coventry. And I was just offered a job working with young girls who were pregnant and were going to a pregnant schoolgirls unit. Just as a teaching assistant, really. And just there I met these incredibly brave young women, many of whom were on their own with their baby, and had arrived at parenthood through all kinds of just hectic, disastrous life experiences. And I thought, yeah, this is where I want to be. So I did 15 years from there in young people's sexual health and teenage pregnancy work and one-to-one work with girls that were in violent and controlling relationships. And that was a real vocation. So it was a surprise to me when another vocation came along with the priesthood. So I was really fortunate. I'm fortunate to have had two. Some people don't get any.
Well, I think the career guidance advice was probably perfect.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, you had a gap period and worked out what you wanted to do, perhaps.
Well, he didn't suggest that. So if he had, the path would have gone differently. But, you know, nothing is ever wasted, is it, really?
The 15 years was spent where?
In Coventry.
In Coventry.
Back in Coventry, yeah.
And then theology beckons.
Yes.
And where do you go and study theology?
Well, in between times, between on that journey through sexual health and teenage pregnancy work, I accidentally stumbled across this world issue about sex trafficking and children being bought and sold for sex. So when I got accepted to train for ordination, I thought, well, I'm going to have to live with no money for the next 2 years. So I might as well make that happen sooner. So left my job and went off to India, and did some work with charities that were rescuing and rehabilitating women and children from the sex trade. So that was really transformational. That changed the path of all kinds of things for me. Because people shouldn't be bought and sold, fundamental, you know. So yeah, in between the youth work and ordination training, I was a charity worker. So then I came back and went straight to theological college and lived in a monastery for 2 years
And where was that?
in Murfield, a little town just near to Leeds. And lived 24/7 with people training for ordination and with a religious community. So I sat and chanted psalms with monks every day for 2 years, and got taught to say my prayers, which is the best training for ordination.
So I'm assuming that was a place that Henry VIII didn't entirely tear down.
Yeah, he'd kept his hands off that one.
Now, you are here in Beaconsfield slash Fremantle administering to the faithful of the Church of England roundabout. Were you brought up in the Church of England?
I wasn't actually. I was brought up in the Baptist Church and was in the Baptist Church from when I was 4 until I was 24. And at 24, my marriage broke up, and my first marriage, and the Baptist Church said that I couldn't go there anymore.
They didn't like divorcees.
They didn't like divorced women.
Divorced women.
My particular church, yeah. The man was allowed to stay, but I had to leave.
Is that
So
right?
it was very sad, yeah.
Well, it's something that many religions and Christianity for a long time, if not today, has adhered to.
Yeah, St. Paul's is not like that at all.
We'll come to St. Paul's.
Yeah, so I at that point thought, well, then I'm not interested in the church or God, if that's what the church stands for. So I had a year where I was angry with everyone and everything, and definitely with Christians. They're the worst. And then God found me in a tent on the south coast of England and lured me back in. And my nearest church then was an Anglican church. So I joined the Anglican church at 25
And here
and
you are.
have loved and served her ever since.
Well, where is this magical place to which people can make a pilgrimage in the south of England?
It was a holiday camp, Butlin's holiday camp,
A Butlin's
and
holiday camp.
yeah, and once a year a big Christian organization would take over this holiday camp and 15,000 Christians would descend on it. I hated Christians. Like, why on earth was I at a Christian holiday camp? Anyway, while I was there, God collared me. And then later, literally collared me with my dog collar.
You've got the collar now.
I got collared twice.
I'll take a photo of you shortly, and our listeners will be able to see how
Oh,
splendid you look in it.
I'd have done my hair if I'd have known.
Well, it looks perfect. So here you are. You've explained briefly you came to Australia. You saw Fremantle for a short time. How did you come to hear about the position you now occupy?
So, I was not planning to move to Australia. In fact, on the plane on the way over here, I thought to myself, flip, this is a really long way. I'm never doing this journey again. So that's working out well for me. But COVID hit. I was engaged to be married and COVID cancelled 3 of our wedding dates. We kept optimistically rebooking and 3 times we had to cancel it. And so in the end, it was just more possible for me to get here than for Craig to get to me in the UK. And God asked me to come, like gave me this holy invitation, like, do you want to come to Australia? Like, we could get up to some real holy mischief. And I love a bit of mischief. So that was that. So I started looking on the Perth website, Diocese of Perth Anglican Church website, and there were lots of vacancies. And I read the blurb about each church, and the church speaks in code. So if you're a clergy person looking for a vacancy, you have to decipher the code as to whether this is a place that you might fit. So I kind of tried to decipher various places and was like, don't know, I'm not sure. And then I clicked on the link for St. Paul's and I read, I think, about one sentence, and I just called my future husband, Craig, and said, oh my gosh, I found the church. I don't care where you're living. I'm going to Beaconsfield. Because he was still living in the northern suburbs then. So, and I'd call him and say, what about? And he'd say, I'm not moving there from here. So when I said, I'm going to Fremantle, he said, brilliant, we're all coming. So that was that. And I felt like it was such a fit what I was reading that I almost felt sorry for anyone else who might apply, because it was my job. Like, I read it and I said, where else could I go? Who else could fit there? It was a match.
Some of it was obviously written in code. Some of it was reasonably explicit by the sound of it. But what was it that was written in code or otherwise that you knew was talking to you?
There was a sentence that said something about working together to encounter the divine. And I thought, the first thing I thought was, oh, brilliant, this church doesn't describe God as he. Because all of that patriarchal language is so unhelpful. And that patriarchal shit was the stuff that meant that the Baptist church said that I had to leave, and that the church has used for generations to oppress women. And that is not my encounter with God through Jesus. So to read that even on the headline of the website, there is no gender assigned to God other than the divine, that just totally led me in. That blew me away. I've never found a church website that would be straight out there and say, you know, come and walk together with us to try and find the divine. Yes, please. Absolutely, I will.
My religion organisational understanding at the moment is not as complete perhaps as it once was, but I'm assuming that not every website of every Anglican church, as you called it, might have spoken to you in the same way.
Fact, yeah.
So just taking Western Australia or Australia as a whole, we might talk about the place where the church originated shortly. Do they all have women priests?
In WA, yeah, there are women priests. We've got a female archbishop, which is amazing.
Who installed you?
Yeah, and a female bishop. And about a third of the clergy here are female. There are other states where they don't ordain women. They don't ordain women in Sydney. And in the Roman Catholic Church, they still don't ordain women.
At all?
No.
No.
In the Anglican Church and the Church of England, then women have equal ministerial rights as men.
And that's the same in the UK?
Yeah, it is now.
And what about the old Baptists?
I don't feel like I parted ways with the Baptists. I learned a lot from my days in the Baptist church, and it was where I learned most of my Bible at that age. It was really helpful for, I had great Sunday school teachers, I had a wonderful choir leader, I had great friends, but I don't know about the leadership because I never reached that point. And I guess it's probably as broad as the Church of England is. The one I was in was pretty fundamental, and there were only men in leadership there. But I'm sure that there are female Baptist ministers. I don't know. I just need to look into it.
Now, some of our listeners won't be as familiar with some of the things we're talking about. I expect they'll be interested, though. We come across expressions like, if you're brought up in Australia and the kids had to indicate their religion, they'd simply say C of E.
Yeah.
But when they went off to services on a Sunday morning, they were going to the Anglican church. Are they interchangeable Same. Expressions everywhere?
Yeah. So C of E stands for Church of England. And the Anglican Church of Australia is part of the Anglican Communion, as is the Church of England. So the Anglican Communion is worldwide, and the Church of England is part of that. And because of all those English people who came and marched all over this country, for a while there was what was still called the Church of England, but now it's known as the Anglican Church.
Now, here in Fremantle, what are your main pastoral responsibilities?
Gosh, well, there are many. It's many and varied. When I arrived here, I wasn't sure what my core purpose would be. So I decided I would just say yes to every opportunity until I could figure out what ministry and life in WA looks like. So this week is probably a good example in that on Monday I was advocating for a refugee in the community who had been released after detention for, he was detained for 9.5 years for arriving in Australia by boat. And then yesterday I was again up at the prison at Perth Airport visiting another detainee who's been locked up for more than 10 years. And he arrived in Australia by boat, and he's still detained. So work with the refugee community is quite a part of my work here. I'm also involved in work with our Aboriginal communities, with the Social Responsibilities Commission here. I can't help myself. Wherever I go, I find those people who are most marginalised, most oppressed, most forgotten, and they're the people I want to be alongside because they're the people who Jesus would find and sit with. My primary purposes are to find out, seek out, and sit with those people.
That was going to be my next question. Do people find you or do you find them, or is it a bit of both?
It's definitely a bit of both, yeah. Opportunities arise and then you kind of get a reputation of like, oh, well, Gemma would want to know about that, or Gemma might help, or the people of Beaconsfield. Like, that's the thing. St Paul's has a historical reputation of being a place that is really concerned about social justice. Absolutely. That was the, once I'd read further on the website, I thought, oh, well then, even more so, you know, these people are activists for social change. When that reputation starts to build, then more and more opportunities come your way. And then you meet people who tell you about people. And then before you know it, your diary is full of, today I'm going to change the world, and then tomorrow I'm going to change the world. And yeah, before you know it, you're pretty busy. It's a lot to change.
where we are at St Paul's in the grounds,
yeah,
it's a rather beautiful and peaceful place, isn't it?
It's not bad, is it?
Really lovely.
We do live in paradise.
When it came to that community you've described, the St Paul's community,
yeah,
which I take it has its own governance structure, are they, in that sense, autonomous? Did they then look and see what code and express provisions there were in your application, and did they get to hire you, or does it have to be given the imprimatur somewhere else?
So it was a panel interview. So there were four people from the parish council, which is like the governing body of the church, and then there were four people from the diocese, so a bishop, an archdeacon, and two clergy people who have been nominated onto a board for selecting new clergy. So I had to convince all eight of them that I might be a match for this place, and that this might be a home for both of us. You know, for it must be awful if you're appointed somewhere where you don't fit. Like, it's not good for the people, it's not good for the clergy person, it's just a clash, and it leads to difficulties. And so a lot of work goes into finding, it's like a dating site, I guess. And so you have these interviews to see if you want to pursue a relationship together. And some people during those interviews are convinced as soon as you walk in and say hi, and others might take a bit of winning over. And I was, they had me at hello.
It must be wonderful to have a supportive community in your church.
They're amazing, honestly. They're really amazing people.
Hartlepool, as I may be incorrectly recalling it at the last UK elections.
Oh my word.
Suddenly did what they'd never done. You were talking about your parents and their political convictions. They, in that part of the world, went entirely the other way and put in a new Tory government. Was there something to be learned as a priest, as a pastoral carer? Did you learn anything from that? About people, about
communities? It was horrendous. It was so horrendous. I was there at that last election, and Hartlepool hadn't had a Tory government for ever, I think. And it became a battleground for the politicians, and they were suddenly all over the town, and Labour didn't do a really very good job of representing themselves, because Hartlepool was at the end of a train line, so you had to deliberately go there. You didn't ever go through it. And the Conservative government that were in had tried out all manner of new ideas on the people of Hartlepool and had decimated the town. Like, I absolutely believe that the Tory government brought Hartlepool to its knees. And then they sowed seeds of suspicion and false hope. And when people are desperate, they'll cling to both of those things. And so people started to believe that, enough people started to believe that a Tory government, the Conservative Party, would change their fortunes and give them back what had long been theirs, that had been stripped away by previous governments, industry and rights over the land and things. And that was never going to happen, and it has never happened. And the people of Hartlepool continue to be abused and downtrodden by the Tory government, in my opinion. And yet they believed the propaganda, and it was really hard to minister at that time, because I was running a soup kitchen, and we would have more than 200 people come each Thursday, destitute, homeless, hungry, some were addicted, some had families that they couldn't feed. I had school teachers calling me up saying, "We've got hungry kids in school, how can you help?" And it was just heartbreaking because it was like I couldn't speak loudly enough to make the connection in people's minds that said, these are the people, like, you're taking from the hand that's been beating you, and people were just daring to hope for more because they couldn't believe it would be worse. So they were saying, well, what's Labour done for us? And I was thinking, but we were so disjointed from London, and oh man, it was brutal. It was really depressing. Keir Starmer actually came and visited me in Hartlepool and asked for a meeting with me because I said, for the first time, I wasn't going to vote Labour, I was going to vote independent because Labour, I couldn't get behind a party that were not caring for my town. And he came and met me on the beach. It was very odd, with a camera crew, and then managed to stage these pictures that made it look like I was laughing along with Keir Starmer. So manipulative. Oh man, politics makes me mad.
You weren't both barefooted, were you?
No, absolutely not.
I'm a little older than you, the age of some of your parishioners, I'm sure. I mean, the baby boomer section one mm-hmm. generation. When I was brought up in country Western Australia in the 50s into the 60s, it was quite a sectarian society. Although in Australia, I don't think the sectarianism, at least in my experience, was too nasty, but most of the population seemed to put their hand up for one Christian sect or another.
Yeah.
But things changed over time.
Mm.
And you'll be more aware than most, and me probably, about what all the statistics show us mm-hmm. about the decline of Christianity in its traditional strongholds in the West, probably throughout Europe. But in Australia these days, mm-hmm. I think there are as many non-theists, people like me, who in the same numbers as people who subscribe to formal Christianity and other religions. Does that present a challenge today? Do you only operate in your own formal religious sphere, or do the churches have an approach that seeks to take everyone in?
So our slogan at St Paul's is where everyone is welcome. And I think lots of places of worship would say that everyone is welcome, and often that is the case, and sometimes it isn't the case. But genuinely at St Paul's, everyone is genuinely welcome. So people will say to me, oh, I'd love to come and see what your church is like, but I can't because I'm atheist. And I say, oh, you'll find some of them here. I'd love to come to your church, but I guess I'm a bit more Buddhist than Christian. And I say, oh, you'll find some of them here. We've got such an eclectic mix of people. Got several lapsed Catholics. So for me, like, Jesus was not sectarian in any way. He called people to be his followers who were Jews and Gentiles and tax collectors and women. And he wasn't bothered. I mean, he was very bothered. That was the point. So I think as a church, we need to be, like, good churches strive to be like Christ rather than like the church, capital T, capital C. And if faith communities are striving to be like the goodness that we believe in that is found in God, then that crosses all boundaries, all sectarian lines. Like, there's no way of aligning yourself with one or the other, because all are welcome. And Jesus didn't espouse this thing that says, oh yeah, you can come, but you need to, like, if you just wait outside, or if you just, you're not on the list. And so, no, I don't stick to any one sphere, except for, like, I'm not diluted and washed down and bland so that everyone feels comfortable and will fit that way. But the sphere that I try to stick to is the invitation of Christ, which is a beyond and above and, around any kind of boundary. Because as soon as you draw a boundary, you then find that Jesus is the other side of it. So then you either need to climb over it or knock it down. So that's part of
Well,
my call.
you may well finish up getting a few extra people attending your services once they've
9:15 on Sunday mornings.
That's very early, Gemma.
I know it is. It's a good job I only live next door.
Yes, you're very lucky.
Yeah.
You hear the people rattling in and think it better get up
But
quickly.
people get up so early in Frio. Like, I'm at the gym at 7 o'clock each morning, and there's always several people there. Like, people don't sleep in this place.
Well, if they're not there, they're down at the beach.
Yeah.
Amazing. Let's just turn briefly to the day-to-dayness of the job. I mean, you have to get up, you have to put on your dog collar at some point, I imagine. You have things to do. You have to put the milk out for the cat, so to speak. You have to go through a routine. What are the things that happen in the daily life for you? You've mentioned 9:30 Sunday mornings. There'll be other liturgical events, plus the advocacy work you're talking about. How does it work, and how do you do the life work balance?
So each morning at 6:30 we have morning prayer. So that's the first thing I do each day, and then I go to the gym. So the first sort of 2 hours of the day is pretty well set every day with morning prayer, gym, shower, dog walk. So then we're good to go. And there's a lot of admin to do in the priesthood. It's crazy. Like, I thought most of my life would be spent saying prayers and sitting by bedsides or something. I don't know what I thought it was going to be.
Too much time in that monastery.
Yeah, I don't know what I thought I was going to do. But there's a lot of emails. There's many meetings. So some of those will be about the day-to-day running, who's going to change the light bulbs, has the place been cleaned, and all of that day-to-day, are there loo rolls in the toilet type conversations. Then there's always a kind of development aspect. What do we need to do to keep our buildings right? How are we going to develop the life of the church? How will we encourage more people to come? This is the sort of church where I will unashamedly invite everyone all of the time because it's the sort of church I would want to go to. Like, if I wasn't a priest, I'd come here. So there is a lot of time spent in trying to get the word out that these things are happening. St. Paul's is a great place to be. So that takes time. You've already said about the advocacy work with the refugees. There are meetings with head office, senior staff. There's meetings about work with refugees, about raising awareness of domestic violence and how the church should respond to that. I have regular meetings about how the church might respond to the slavery issue. It's just such a catalogue of things. And then there's hospital visiting, home visits for those who can't get to church. Someone calls me and says, "Help, my dad has died." And so then there's a pastoral visit there. There's wedding prep, baptism meetings, funerals. I mean, no 2 days are the same.
And the work-life balance.
Oh, yeah. So I go to the gym and I walk the dog. I have a great husband who likes to whisk me away from time to time. So we go to the many amazing restaurants in Fremantle. We're working our way through the urban list of top 20 restaurants. So that's never a chore. We live 10-minute walk from the beach, so I like to go and get in the ocean. I really don't struggle with a work-life balance here.
And you have time to put some music on? So tell me, what are your tastes in music?
Oh,
Is this sort of the
interesting.
Coventry girl or the Hartlepool woman?
Yeah, I quite like listening to like angsty women. I like good lyrics. So that sometimes takes me into a more sort of hip hop world. I've got a stepson of 14 who listens to very loud, shouty music in the house. So, but then also he'll suddenly play Wham or Bing Crosby or something like that. I know, I was trying to get through Advent without hearing Last Christmas, and he whamageddoned me. I said, I can't believe my own stepson has whamageddoned me at this early stage. Yeah, so there is often a lot of music in the house, and I also love a crime drama. Love a crime drama. So me and my husband chomp our way through whole, binge watch some series on Netflix or other viewing platforms.
Once upon a time, and I think this church here might be a testament to it, there would have been huge numbers of parishioners. Someone told me they might have even had five football teams here.
Correct, yeah.
This is around the time of what, the First War?
Yeah. So the church was half built, not half built, more than half built, nearly finished when World War One started. And obviously all of the men were enlisted and had to go off. So a temporary wall was put on the east end of church, which is like the back end. And then like I think around 80 men, maybe closer to 90, just didn't return. And they were the people that were the stonemasons and the builders and the architects, I guess, and the grafters. And so the church remained with a temporary wall until about 15 years ago, to the point where you couldn't just see light coming in, you could actually put your hand through the crack in the wall and touch the outside air, and the wall was falling inwards. So if it had actually fallen, the poor priest would have been squashed while they said mass. And so then a big redevelopment happened in the church, and we got our beautiful, stunning chapel put on the back and a permanent wall. And a housing development and meeting room and all kinds of other facilities. So, yeah, but it would have been very different if those men had returned or if the war hadn't broke out.
A story not unlike that of Coventry Cathedral,
Well done.
isn't it?
Yeah, Coventry Cathedral. I spent 2 years working there as a schools worker. So I did a lot of the tours around the old ruined cathedral that was kept after it was destroyed in Second World War, and the new cathedral that was built alongside it. So the whole site now tells the story of death with the old cathedral and then resurrection with the new cathedral. So it tells the Easter, what we call the Triduum, the 3 days from death to life. It's an amazing place with a real International Ministry of Reconciliation. It's very inspiring.
We'll draw this really lovely conversation to an end, Gemma. We have wars, we have peace, we think we've achieved some reconciliation. Sometimes we do, but
Sometimes.
it's not universal. We've got people fighting around Ukraine at the moment.
It's ongoing, isn't it? You can't ever achieve peace and reconciliation. You can just always do the next thing to work towards it, I think.
And that, I imagine, is your mission, one
If
way or another.
I choose to accept it, which I do.
Emma, it's been lovely talking to you. Thanks for meeting today.
Thank you.